This week on Earth Ancients, we give you a preview. A preview of the scans that were conducted on the Great Khufu Pyramid at the Giza Plateau in Egypt. Up until now, we have known there was a void that was detected and some other anomalous features that are to this day still questionable. But my guest today has detected enough to provide us with insight into what this new discovery means, the history of the Great Pyramid, and why Egyptologists are afraid to reveal the contents of this secret, unknown chamber. This is the full program, including a full presentation by the Scan Pyramid team and what they discovered using the latest scanning technology available today. All this and more on Earth Ancients. Saturday, July 10th, 2021. This is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. This is going to be a fun week. I'm really looking forward to all the components of this look inside the Great Pyramid, the Khufu Pyramid in Egypt, the Giza Plateau. I have been talking about it for months. I've been announcing this. And today, this entire program can be considered a special event because I don't know anybody else who is going to be talking about the scientific team known collectively as the Scan Pyramid team. If anyone's been talking about it with the great level that we are, and we're introducing a brand new book by Scott Creighton, called The Great Pyramid Void Enigma, and that is our program today. And no one is talking about Scott's work, and he is an engineer. We've had him on the show. It's been a while. It's been a few years, but whenever he comes on, we get a really good and accurate look at the Great Pyramid from an engineering point of view. And this is the big issue that a lot of people have regarding Egyptology, is they just can't get over themselves and they seem to trip and fall when it comes to explaining how the Great Pyramid was built, what is the mechanism built into the Great Pyramid, and why was it created in the first place? You know, to say it was a tomb is becoming a huge joke on the same level as cutting granite with copper chisels and wooden mallets. So, and this doesn't change. This doesn't change with this collective of people who are called Egyptologists. It's the same backward level of thinking without really providing anything that is logical. It's illogical, most of the stuff they talk about. And this is why I was flabbergasted. If you happen to catch the program we did with Dr. Kara Cooney, tenured professor, who's an Egyptologist, but really an archaeologist, turned out to be a friend of mine. We've become real close. She's down in UCLA. She says Egyptology is dead. And what we'll hear today basically puts the nails in the coffin on this very backward and outdated thought process that noted individuals like Zahi Hawass, Mark Lerner, and many others seem to follow without any kind of logic, and it's damning to their community. And yet, this is the problem we faced in our institutions, is this narrative that doesn't make sense, has no scientific basis, and in fact, when people who have spent their life analyzing buildings, understanding physics, and so forth and so on, review these megalithic buildings, they come to a completely different opinion than what we are told by Egyptological people. So anyhow, that is kind of an introduction to what we're going to do today. So we're going to hear from the Scan Pyramid team in our news area. We won't hear from Bruce Fenton today. This is, like I said, this is a special edition of Earth Ancients. We're going to hear a preview of the technology, the team as it was assembled, what they discovered. And by the way, they did not just discover a huge void in the upper chamber of the Great Pyramid, the Khufu Pyramid. They also discovered a hallway almost to the, I think it was just above the entrance, the original entranceway. And also we're going to hear about the number of times they scan the pyramid, what came back to them. And now remember, this was announced in 2017, so it's been a few years since we've heard anything from them. And so we will hear about the technology, we'll hear about the purpose, and then we'll ask why we have not heard about these results and why there hasn't been any follow-up. So we have evidence, we have a proof, and apparently this technology is so accurate. It's 99% accurate to what has been discovered. And, you know, how are we going to proceed? Are we going to drill into the limestone, into this room to see what's in there? Or are we going to sit and wait for this backward community of Egyptologists to feel that we can do this? Now, this brings up all kinds of questions and concerns. Remember, Edgar Cayce predicted that the Great Hall of Records would be found in the Giza Plateau. We'll hear from Scott about his opinion of that. But if this is an actual repository for data, is this a reason for Egyptologists to hunker down and refuse to? And we're talking about the Antiquities Department of Egypt. These are the Egyptian authorities who have flatly refused to take this discovery to the next step, the opening of this room, seeing what's in it. Hey, if it's empty, it's empty. But at least we have another riddle solved of the Great Pyramid. Scott Crichton does not believe this is an empty room. Based on his research, he believes it's a significant discovery, and we'll hear just exactly what he has discovered and found. So the program today will present to us a history of this pyramid. Scott very insightfully provides the different people over the last few hundred years who have made inroads into discovering what the Great Pyramid was, perhaps how it functioned, and what remains to be seen in terms of the parts and the functionality that is built into this building. Now, this pyramid. Now, we've had other engineers on the program, most notably Chris Dunn, who wrote Giza Power Plant, and he believes that the Grand Gallery, which we'll discuss today, was a portion of a mechanism, and there's deep slots in the gallery that look like they were used to house different pieces of equipment, or perhaps they supported mechanisms or engines or something, and they were removed hundreds, perhaps thousands of years ago, following the use of the Great Pyramid. So it's interesting to note what Scott has to say, our guest today, on the design of the Great Pyramid and its functionality, because that's always been the great question. I had a chance a couple of years ago to actually go in and walk around undisturbed and see each of these rooms, the king, the queen's chamber, the subterranean chamber, the grand gallery, and so on. And it's something out of, from outer space. It's so sophisticated and so anomalous. And it's like when we think of dynastic Egyptians and we look at this thing, it's like, was it actually made by a pharaoh's engineers or whatever? It seems very unlikely. The other question that is of concern is, did Khufu actually build the pyramid or did he repair it? There's a great question. In fact, there's a stele in front of the Sphinx that says he repaired both the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid like 4,500 years ago. There's a great deal of question that the Great Pyramids perhaps post-flood or post-ice age. And it's, 10, 12, 15 plus thousand years old. And it is a relic from the previous civilization. That tends to be my feeling based on the years of interacting with professionals who have scanned, analyzed it from engineering, physics, scientific basis. Very rarely do I have an Egyptologist on the show, except for Kara. Kara talks about the kings and the queens and their reign. There isn't any real reason to have an Egyptologist talk about the Great Pyramid and its function beyond being a tomb for a king. And that's a sad statement. And I think it's probably because I know better to have that on my show. It runs in the face of common sense, but also true science. And a lot of people feel that Egyptology is not a science. It's more like a liberal arts field of study. So I don't want to crucify the entire industry, the entire community of Egyptologists, but it is really a problem right now when we begin looking at the ancient past. And that's what Earth Ancients is all about. Looking at buildings, temples, and other megalithic structures. Megaliths, huge multi-ton blocks cut with a level of precision. The tip-off, how they would cut it, the tools they used, how they moved up into the place. And when you see the Great Pyramid up close and personal, it is awe-inspiring and it is out of this world. And it's so, so, so anomalous. It's like, who built this and what? How did this thing work? So we're trying to unveil the puzzle. And this is our program today on the Great Pyramid Void Enigma.
The boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
In this segment, we're going to talk about scan pyramids, the mission behind the scanning, the detecting of voids in the Great Pyramid, and what we understand to have been discovered. This team of experts was assembled and the project was launched in October of 2015. And the goal was to use several non-invasive, non-destructive techniques to better understand the structure of the pyramid, the construction processes, and also what may be hidden from us in the form of rooms, voids, and other chambers that are part of the original design of the pyramid. Oddly enough, in November of 2017, the Egyptologist Zahi Hawass basically said that they have found nothing and that the scan pyramid team's paper, which was published in the prestigious Nature magazine, offers nothing to Egyptology. What we're going to hear now is a short 6-minute presentation of the team as it was assembled, the technology that was used, what they discovered, and this is reported on to us in 2017, and also what is the follow-up.
It's one of the 7 wonders of the world. Yet the Great Pyramid of Giza has never yielded all its secrets. No major new structure has been discovered since the Middle Ages. Nobody's ever fathomed how it was built 4,500 years ago. But in November 2017, the Scan Pyramids team published their findings in Nature magazine. They announced a new major discovery at the very heart of the pyramid. They detected above the Grand Gallery a previously unknown cavity at least 30 meters long. They named it SPBV, Scan Pyramids Big Void. It's the second important discovery the researchers have made after the announcement in October 2016 of a corridor situated behind the gigantic chevrons of the north face. The level of confidence of these discoveries is more than 5 sigma. In other words, it's 1 in 3.5 million that these findings are by chance. Designed and directed by Cairo University and the HIP Institute, the Scan Pyramids mission began in October 2015. Its aim is to use non-invasive methods to scan the pyramid and detect unknown internal structures in order to better understand the Old Kingdom pyramids. The Scan Pyramids team of French, Japanese, and Egyptian scientists used a penetrating radiography technique called muography. The Earth and everything on it, including the Great Pyramid, is permanently bombarded by minuscule, invisible particles, muons, byproducts of cosmic rays only partially absorbed by stone. The more these elementary particles from space hit matter on the journey, the more they're stopped in their tracks. The idea is to place inside the structure devices to count the number of muons that cross through it and work out their distribution angle. It's rather like an X-ray on a human being. Muography will help detect the differences in density inside the pyramid and provide an internal image of the monument. 3 different techniques of muography were used, each independent of the other, and each was corroborated by in-depth computer simulations. First, Nagoya University used plates containing a chemical film sensitive to muons. Then another Japanese team from the KEK Institute transported piece by minute piece and then reassembled a very sophisticated device inside the Queen's Chamber. It was a scintillator, an electronic instrument that uses different technology to detect the muons. Finally, at the foot of the north face, a third team installed equipment outside the pyramid. This was the French team from the CEA. They were working with yet another different muographic method, telescopes fitted with gas detectors. In 2016, Nagoya University's compact devices revealed the existence of the cavity situated behind the chevrons of the north face, but without being able to determine its architectural shape. In 2017, 2018, and 2019, new plates were hung along the descending corridor and also in the niches of the Al Mamun Tunnel. All the experiments reconfirmed the existence of the cavity that they named the Scan Pyramid's North Face Corridor, between 17 and 23 meters above ground level. A corridor at least 5 meters long. The corridor is horizontal, or perhaps sloping upwards, and the theory of a corridor going down and parallel to the descending corridor has been ruled out. But that's not all. The scientists from the Scan Pyramids mission also made progress on understanding the Scan Pyramids Big Void, refining their data analysis. Since the publication 2 years ago in Nature magazine, they continue their research and gather millions of new data to look at it from new points of view inside the Great Pyramid. The CEA had set up new equipment in the Grand Gallery with several angles to observe the big void above this space, and the Nagoya University also placed emulsion plates at several points along the Grand Gallery. Then other plates were installed at the entrance to the King's Chamber, and above it in the relieving chambers. The big void was again observed from these new measuring points, confirming and refining the results published in 2017. The cavity is just above the Grand Gallery, between 10 and 15 metres above. Its minimum length, estimated initially at 30 metres, has been re-evaluated to 40 metres minimum, probably in one single section. However, the mission scientists continue to debate about a slope. And there's more. The plates placed above the King's Chamber detected no anomaly between the arches above and the summit of the pyramid. Finally, during the summer of 2018, the team moved the KEK scintillator into the unfinished underground chamber, and the Nagoya emulsion plates were positioned in several places. This muon data capture is still ongoing. In 2020, the Scan Pyramids project will carry on to gather more data from the very heart of the Great Pyramid. Once again, emulsion plates will be installed and the CEA's muon telescopes will be placed in the descending passage to understand more about how the discovered North Face corridor located above extends behind the chevrons of the North Face. Enough to motivate the scientists to think about minimally invasive methods to explore this corridor, which could prove key to understanding how the Egyptians built the Great Pyramid.
You can see the video of this team and their work on the Facebook page. Go to Facebook, Earth Ancients, go to the group page, and the video is there. It's also on earthancients.com, and you'll see it under Facebook feed. One aspect of doing Earth Ancients is to occasionally have an author on that writes on a subject that is not only in the news, but really focuses on a problem that has really not been answered yet. And my guest today is Scott Creighton, who has written a new book called The Great Pyramid Void Enigma, The Mystery of the Halls of the Ancients. And we've had Scott on before. We had him on a few years ago. His last book was The Great Pyramid Hoax. And it's fun to have Scott on because he's an engineer. And I always tell people, looking at ancient dwellings, megaliths, from a archaeological or Egyptological point of view is very, very limited. And the only way we get the answers we need is to look at it multidisciplinary. And this is the beauty of Scott's work on this void in the Great Pyramid. Now, I've been talking about this for months. In 2017, an international team of scientists published their results of a two-year-long research study scanning the Great Pyramid and discovering a void above the King's Chamber, the King's room where they think there was a body at some time. We never got the results of this because the Egyptological community not only freaked out, but strangely enough, almost disavowed the work that had been done by this group of scientists. It was such an odd situation. I spoke up about it for a number of months, but we're basically at a loss because we, you know, there's no control of these this governing body in Egypt who makes the decisions to bring out the information. So it's with great pride and a welcoming that we have Scott back to talk about this new book, The Great Pyramid Void Enigma. So, Scott, welcome back to Earth Ancients. How are you?
I'm good, Cliff. It's good to be here. It's been, I think, a few years now, yeah. So, yeah, it's good to be back.
Yeah, I think it's been 4 or 5 years. It's been quite a while. So,
yeah.
But you really created a fantastic look at this enigma of this void. So, I have a lot to talk about, but first thing I want to get into the first part of this book, where you begin talking about the construction, the alignments, and perhaps the original purpose of this, what we call the Great Pyramid. It's your belief that the Pharaoh Khufu actually did build a pyramid. Is that correct?
Okay, that's a good question. It depends. Okay, it's if I can put my sort of conditional sort of answer here. Egypt, the history that has come down to us about the Great Void is from the Coptic Egyptians. Now, the Copts were the indigenous people in Egypt and have always been in Egypt. And then, obviously, in time around 2,000 years ago, they became Christians and so forth and so on. But they've always been in Egypt and have always carried their own history. Now, it is the Copts who pass on these legends to us about what or the reason why the pyramids were actually built. And they tell us that they were built by King Saurid or Surid, which could be the name Sufis, or a slight corruption of the name Sufis. Now, Sufis is what Egyptologists believe was the original or the Greek name for the pharaoh Khufu. So Khufu is the Egyptian name. It transliterates into Sufis, which is the Greek name for Khufu. The name Saurid, which the Coptic Egyptians have passed down to us, could be a corruption of the name Sufis. So yes, it could be that Khufu did build the structure, the Great Pyramid. However, I will qualify that again further in saying that Egyptologists believe that Khufu lived about 4,500 years ago. I think it was much, much further back in time that Khufu lived. So,
okay, yeah, because that makes sense to me. I'm glad you explained that. Obviously, the Egyptologists use the various hieroglyphics that have been found within the pyramid to claim that Khufu was the great builder. In fact, they even go further and say there's a stela in front of the Sphinx that names Khufu as potentially somebody who constructed parts of the Giza Plateau. But would you say the proof that Khufu was the builder, just the Coptic text, the pre-Egyptian text, or is there any other documents that give us a highlight as to who built the Great Pyramid?
Well, there are other reasons why I believe it probably was Khufu. Mm-hmm. And there's actually, if my theory about this big void is correct, then actually, you know, within the book you'll find there's actually very compelling evidence. Then if this theory is correct, then there's good evidence that it was Khufu that built you know, the Great Pyramid. But, you know, Cliff, you were talking there a few moments ago about these markings inside, these painted markings inside the Great Pyramid, which I discussed at great length in my previous book, The Great Pyramid Hoax. Now, these markings have this king's name in these hidden chambers, which Colonel Weiss, a British antiquarian, used gunpowder to blast his way into in 1837. And he claims that he discovered this king's name painted onto the walls of these narrow chambers. Now, they're not big chambers. I mean, that you can only crawl through them. You can't even stand up. Yeah. You have to crawl through these. So they're not really chambers. They're just sort of like small voids, if you like, very small spaces. You have to crawl basically on your hands and knees through these spaces. Now, he found these markings, allegedly, of this king in these spaces. Now, there's five of these spaces altogether, Cliff, there's five of them altogether, and the bottom most of these five chambers, it was always open since the pyramid was built.
You mean the subterranean chamber?
No. I'm talking here, Cliff, about the king's chamber. Just above the roof of the king's chamber, one of these small apartments, just right above the king's chamber, there's one of these small apartments which has always been accessible. But to access it, you have to go, you know, the Grand Gallery?
Yeah.
You know, 26.5 degree angle, this massive gallery. It's kind of angled like that. At the top of this gallery, there's a small antechamber. Now, if this is the floor of the gallery, then you've got a wall that's 30 foot high. At the top of this wall here, there's a small hole about 2 feet by 2 feet that you have to basically crawl through to get into this chamber, this small chamber. It's always been open. And it was discovered, I think, in 1865, 67, something like that, by Nathaniel Davison, who was the British consul to Algiers at the time. Anyway, he discovered this. Now, he didn't discover any painted marks in this chamber at all. Now, fast forward to the 1830s, a chap called Giovanni Caviglia, who was well-respected in Egypt at the time, he used this small space as his living quarters because he was doing some investigations into the pyramid. And he thought one night to poke or read a stem of grass, a long stem of grass, you know, about 3-4 feet, up through, you could see a small crack between two of the ceiling blocks of this chamber. So he poked this long stem of grass up, and it went all the way and kept going and going and going and going. And he realized there's another chamber above there. Now, fast forward a few years later, he passed this information on to his new colleague or business partner to investigate the pyramids at this time, which was Colonel Weiss, the British colonel. So he explained his theory to Weiss, and shortly afterwards, Caviglia found himself kicked off the site by Colonel Weiss. Colonel Weiss, I personally think, manufactured a grievance to have Caviglia kicked off the site, and Weiss went on to discover these chambers. Now, Weiss... remember the chamber below that was always open, Davison's, there's no marks in it. There's no marks anywhere else in the pyramid. None.
Yeah.
Apart from, I'll come to this in a moment, but these four chambers, there's marks all over them. The ones that Weiss opened, there's marks everywhere. Okay?
Yeah.
You know, so it begs the question, you know, well, the Davison's chamber, which is virtually identical to these other ones, there's nothing there. But the ones Weiss blasted open, marks everywhere. There's only one other place where they've found marks. You know how the Queen's, there's a shaft, the star shafts, what they call the star shafts. It's, well, the southern shaft from the Queen's chamber, they sent a small robot up, I think, right, in the 1990s. And that came to a small, what they call a door. It's not really a door, it's just a small slab of limestone, and it's only about, you know, I think half a foot, you know, it's very, very small, half a foot square, something like that, maybe 12 inches, I'm not sure. And they drilled through it, and they put an endoscopic camera through the hole, and they found these, what looked like painted marks in this tiny, tiny chamber. Now, that is not the tame chamber. It's just a hole, a small hole, basically. It's only about a foot cubed, you know? It's only about a foot cubed. It's tiny. But they found marks that painted marks at the bottom of this. And they think it's ancient Egyptian hieratic marks. The problem is these marks in this small, tiny, tiny space, they believe have the number 20 written in ancient Egyptian writing, which is called hieratic, okay, at this time. The number 20, or one of the numbers represents 20. Now, this small chamber is built at the same height as the topmost chamber that Weiss blasted his way into. And in this Weiss chamber, it's also got the number 20 written in it, in a completely different script from a completely different time. And if you're working on an engineering project as advanced and complex as the Great Pyramid, you know, you're going to be making sure you're working with the same, you know, number system. You're not going to be chopping and changing different number systems. But the point is that this 20 in this chamber and this, what they believe to be a 20 in this tiny chamber, are from completely different times of ancient Egypt.
Wow.
Of ancient Egypt. So, you know, but that's just one tiny, tiny discrepancy that I've uncovered. As you know, Cliff, you've read The Great Pyramid Hoax. There's a ton of stuff. I mean, as you know, I even found his journal, but which shows all sorts of anomalies.
Whose journal?
Colonel Weiss's private journal. His private journal, because he published a book, but what's in his journal is at odds in very key places, is at odds with what he has published in his book, because his journal's for his, you know, is his private use for his eyes. Yeah. His published book's the sort of sanitized version of his journal, and they are at odds in some very key places. Which, you know, so that we're kind of digress a bit there. So anyway, these Coptic Egyptian legends tell us it was Saurid. Saurid could be Khufu. The other thing that we have to mention about these marks is they found some marks on, or I believe they found marks outside the pyramid painted onto blocks there, which Weiss used to copy into these chambers. So they're genuine. They're genuine, you know, fourth dynasty marks in the sense that they maybe come from that time. But then the pyramid was built way before that time. That's why, you know, I think you mentioned the inventory stela, which talks about Khufu.
Yeah.
Repairing monuments at Giza, like repairing the Sphinx, repairing the Temple of Isis. You know, he's doing repairs at Giza. Now, if the Sphinx was just built, you know, by his son, why is he doing repairs to it?
Yeah, I think we need to also let people know that what you're saying about Weiss is that he painted, likely forged Khufu's cartouche in that upper chamber. And this is what Egyptologists use as a dating for the Great Pyramid. That's the important mark.
Well, yes, he did that. There was actually, he put painted marks in all of these four chambers of this king's name. Well, only two of them really have the king's name in them. But the other point to mention here is that if you look at, you know, the style of these particular cartouches that Weiss claims to have discovered, again, they're from later time. They're from a later time. Even some of the symbols that are used are from a much later time in Egyptian history. Yeah. So he has found genuine marks somewhere from a later period. He wouldn't have known that, and just copied them into the Great Pyramid.
He makes a mess of it because he couldn't leave well enough alone and just accept the original cartouches and what data. He actually decided that he was going to confirm Khufu by adding his cartouche in there. Hey, before we get into the details of this analysis by this multidisciplinary team of scientists, the early part of your book questions the great age of the pyramid. And I want you to talk a little bit about an area that you suggest that which helps us understand the date of the pyramid. You found evidence of water marks, water sediment in the pyramid that makes you feel and hypothesize that the pyramid was as old as the end of the great ice age, mm-hmm. Pleistocene era, or the Younger Dryas. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the Holocene era. Yeah. Now this isn't actually my own personal research. It's this comes from a chap called Sharif or Sher Morsi, and he lives in Cairo, and he's a researcher, independent researcher, and he's done a ton of research on the ground at Giza and has been doing so for about the last 15, 20 years. Now, the work that this guy has done is just remarkable. It's incredible. He shows, where all the erosion patterns on the pyramid blocks, the Great Pyramid blocks, the Middle Pyramid of Khafre. He shows the erosion marks there.
Erosion marks on what part of the pyramid?
Yeah, on the blocks of the pyramid.
Oh, the actual body.
Yeah, the body of the pyramid.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
Yeah, he shows, we always talk about, water erosion, on the Sphinx, which Dr. Robert Schock discovered, or rather John Anthony West discovered and got Robert Schock to confirm. And this chap, Sharif Morsi, has done similar work, but actually on the Great Pyramid, the pyramids themselves, and the stonework of the pyramids themselves. And he's absolutely convinced that there was massive water erosion, or a massive flood had taken place in antiquity and seriously damaged these pyramids. He also has found, down at the smaller of the three pyramids cliff, the Pyramid of Menkaure, or Egyptologists call it G3, at the temple there, there's a wall, and this wall's got limestone blocks in it that weigh about 50 or 60 tons, something like that. And they're stacked one above the other, I think, to about three levels. And this wall has been incredibly eroded. And he tripped one day walking along the top of this temple wall. And he tripped over something and he looked down. And it was an actual complete exoskeleton of a sea urchin.
Ah. Oh.
Yeah. And it was sitting there, slightly embedded, obviously, or encrusted into the top of this limestone block. Now, sea urchins typically will live in shallow, warm lagoons. So this evidence shows that, that area of the plateau was once underwater. Egyptologists try to say, the stone has eroded away and just revealed this. Well, no, that's just an absurd argument. Just an absurd argument, Yeah. We've discovered that all over the place. Typically, limestone is made up of, microscopic particles, that build up over tens of thousands, millions of years, to find a complete exoskeleton of a sea urchin encrusted into the top layer of this block on the temple wall of the third pyramid at Giza. He almost tripped over it, but it was encrusted, it was encased in the wall because it was obviously, sitting there, tens of thousand years ago or whatever, So there's really, really compelling evidence that there was a massive flood at Giza. And those monuments were there when it happened. And there's also sort of older stories. Other researchers have discovered that there were watermarks before the limestone blocks, the sort of casing stones, sort of came away from the Great Pyramid. Because when we look at the Great Pyramid today, what we are actually seeing is the core blocks. We're not actually seeing the finished pyramid, because the pyramid was finished with what are known as Tura limestone casing stones, gleaming white casing stones. And it must have been quite a sight to see when they were all still in place. But anyway, ancient historians have written that there were salt marks, or water marks, I should say, water marks at different levels of the Great Pyramid, where the water gradually reached a certain level and then gradually receded, stayed there for a certain time, and then receded again.
Okay.
Now, if you go inside the Queen's Chamber, which is probably about a third of the way up the pyramid, if you go inside there, or when researchers went in there, they found that the walls inside the Queen's Chamber were encrusted with salt.
Wow.
Now, limestone itself can exude salt. You know, it has salt within it, and this salt can leach out of the actual stone to form a coating on the wall. But this salt that they found has apparently been tested, and it's not limestone salt, which has a different composition. It was sea salt.
And we never hear this from Egyptologists about this extract or this residue on the interior of the Great Pyramid, because that would throw a whole body of questions at them that they probably couldn't answer. Scott, give us your suggested date for the creation of the pyramids. Would you say if they were at the end of the Younger Dryas, it's 12,000 years old?
I think the monuments themselves actually date themselves. I actually show that in the book, how the monuments were laid out to actually date themselves. And it's a bit more complex than the way Bival has shown with the 10,500 BC thing. It's a bit more complex, but in a lot of ways it's much simpler as well, and more compelling, I would argue, than the way that Bival has presented over the years. But to me, it's probably dates to about the middle of the Younger Dryas. About the date that I give in the book, which the monuments themselves seem to date to, is 10,081 BC. That's the date that the monuments themselves actually seem to date to, if my interpretation of the layout of these monuments is actually correct. But the way they've done it, the way they have left this information for us, is really quite incredible and quite remarkable. They were really, really clever astronomers and mathematicians and engineers that built this incredible structure. So I reckon, Cliff, about 12,000, they're about 12,000 years old.
Okay, so let's talk about your interpretation of Robert Bival's alignment, because in his work, he dates the pyramid to an earlier time as well, but he is aligning the pyramid to the Orion constellation, which is extremely old. In fact, he does the same thing with the Great Sphinx. And so what is different about your theory for the alignment compared to what Bival comes up with? Because you're pretty close to his work, but you have a little bit of a twist. And also, in a minute, we want to talk about the crustal displacement element as well. But first of all, let's talk about your hypothesis for the alignment.
Okay. Well, Cliff, the first person to connect the Great Pyramid with it astronomically, the Belt Stars astronomically, was Dr. Virginia Trimble. in 1964, 65, something like that. And she showed that the star shaft in the southern Queen's Chamber, the southern star shaft in the Queen's Chamber, targeted the center belt star of Orion's belt around 2550 BC. Now, she was the first person to do that. So right away there, so she saw that the star was at a certain height in the sky, 45 degrees, it wasn't the Queen's Chamber she used, it was the King's Chamber, my apologies, 45 degree angle from the King's Chamber, due south. The star, the middle star of Orion's belt, was at 45 degrees in 2550 BC. So, but Bivald doesn't measure the date in that way, the height of the star above the horizon. What Bivald has done is he has measured the angle of the star, the three stars, you know, and because over time, the angle of the star, when you're looking at those stars due south, the angle of those three stars over 13,000 years changes like that. Yeah. And then 13,000 years later, it goes back the way. So it's going up and down like that all the time. As is Dr. Trimble's altitude measure, that star at 45 degrees goes all the way up to 56 degrees and then all the way down to 9 degrees. Up and down, up and down. 13,000 years up, 13,000 years down. Now, the point is here, Cliff, why should they be having two different dates? Because think about it. If you are measuring this altitude of this star at 45 degrees, as I said, it goes up to 55, and then within a precessional cycle, there's 26,000 years. So it starts at 9, goes up to 45, keeps on going, and then changes direction, starts coming down again, like an elevator going like that, 26,000 years, 26,000 years, 26,000 years, up and down, 13, 13, 13, 13. So this thing is going, it reaches 45 degrees there in 2,500 BC, but carries on, and then it comes back to 45 degrees within the same precessional cycle, which would be 19,200 BC. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, either of those dates, how does Dr. Trimble know if it was 2,500 BC when that shaft targeted the belt stars at 45 degrees? It could have been when it was on the way down at 19,200 BC.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? There's a contradiction there. And Bivald is the same. Bivald's situation is the same. He did that, right, well, 10,500 BC, the stars are aligned at that angle, which is the same alignment as the three pyramids on the ground at Giza. Yeah. That's how he did it. But he's got the same problem because he's got this thing's going up and down, 13,000 years, it's angled like that. Another 13,000 years, it's angled like that within the precessional cycle. So which one is it? You know, yeah. For Bivald, is it two? Because the next time it will be angled the way Bivald or the way the pyramids are at Giza will be in 2,580, 500 years from now. The last time it was at that angle was 10,500 BC, which is, so Bivald's dates could be either 2,500 AD or 10,500 BC, or, you know, 13,000 years before that, you know. So yeah.
So there's some questions. There are questions about accuracy. Is that what you're suggesting? Yes.
Well, the point is, Cliff, is that you can't just use one alignment or the other. You have to use both at the same time.
Oh, okay.
That's the point, because if you use both alignments at the same time, then that's the only way you can create a unique date.
So let me ask you this, and this is something I see in Mayan pyramid design and pyramid science, is these ancient cultures were very much tapped into as above, so below.
Yeah.
Cosmological science. And what do you think was going on with these ancient pre-Egyptian, these proto or Coptic native people in building these megalithic structures that accurately align to constellations? Now, we know the Maya, and I'm interested in your opinion. We know the Maya lined up their civic centers, pyramids, temples, construction with certain constellational bodies, almost plugged in.
Yeah.
The belief is there's a subtle energy going on here that we don't understand because we're just not sophisticated enough. In your opinion, why would the Egyptians do the same kind of thing with these monstrosities of megalithic construction?
Yeah. Well, it goes back, Cliff, to the Coptic Egyptian legend. And what they tell us is that Surid, Sufis, Khufu, let's just call him Saurid or Surid, he saw the stars in the sky were no longer following their normal path. They had changed. The path that the stars were moving across the sky had changed. And he asked his astronomer priests, what does this mean? And they reported back to him, it says, well, in 300 years, there's going to be a devastating flood which will destroy everything. It will destroy absolutely everything, the entire kingdom. And the king said, okay, what can we do about this? And he decided that what they would do was build pyramids. And into these pyramids, they would place everything that their civilization would need in order to reboot itself after this, the worst effects of this cataclysm has passed. And that's what the Coptic Egyptian ancient texts tell us was the reason for the building of these pyramids.
Wow.
Yeah. They were essentially arcs. And if you look at the early Christian iconography for the ark, it was the shape of a pyramid, you know. There's all these ancient stories that the pyramids essentially served as an ark. And there's stories you've probably heard, the pyramids being referred to at some time. I think it was Greaves who brought this idea, and that they were the granaries of Joseph's granaries, which is actually probably just a corruption of the original legend. The original purpose was, yes, they put a lot of grain and other types, all manner of seeds, inside these structures. Just like our civilization is doing, Cliff, with Svalbard. We have got this seed vault in Svalbard Island in the Norwegian archipelago, where we have placed every single type of seed type there is in the world, you know, as a security against some natural earth disaster, cataclysm, so that we can restart, you know, our civilization again. So the ancient Egyptians were basically doing the same thing that we were doing with their pyramids. That's what their texts tell us they were doing. Now, the thing you have to understand is their religion as well. In their religion, I'll stick with your original point first about the stars, why they were, you know, as above, so below. At Giza, what they're actually doing, because there's three big pyramids there, Cliff, but there's also two sets of smaller pyramids, two triads of smaller pyramids, one beside the Great Pyramid, and one beside the smallest of the three pyramids to the south of the three pyramids. And they're both, you know, perfectly vertically aligned to each other. These three small pyramids, you know, are perfectly aligned in a straight line to each other, but they are rotated 90 degrees to each other. What they are showing, what the Egyptians are showing us there is, yes, the Great Pyramids represent Orion. Have you got that? Good. Right now, what are these three small pyramids showing you? You can't have Orion's belt in two different places. It can only be in one place. What they're showing us is how the stars moved. from one place to another, from one part to another part, from one part of the sky to another part of the sky. That's what they're showing us with these three small sets, two sets of three or triads of pyramids at Giza. They're showing us how Orion's belt moved from one part of the sky to another part of the sky. That's what the legend said. The legend says the stars moved to a different place. They weren't following their normal course. And that is what it's all about. They're showing us the stars move. Now, as you know, Cliff, it's not the stars that move. The stars are fixed. It's the Earth itself that moves. Now, we have got legends from all over the world, you know, from, you know, the indigenous Americans, from, you know, the indigenous people in Greenland and South America and China and Europe and Egypt, you know, and, you know, Israel and Palestine. There's all these ancient texts which speak, it's even in the Bible, that tell us the earth turned over, that tell us the sun once upon a time rose in the west and set in the east.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. There's all these legends from all over the world that tell us this happened, and it happens at regular intervals. It's a natural cycle.
So this is the crustal displacement that you talk about.
Yeah.
Now, how does that affect the understanding of the Great Pyramid, though?
Right. Well, this is what the Coptic Egyptian legend is saying. It's saying the stars were moving out of their place. Now, what they're actually observing is the Earth crust displacement actually in action. They're actually observing this. And they know that their astronomer priests knew that in about 300 years down the road, there was going to be an almighty cataclysm, a devastating flood that would destroy everything. So this event is happening. The earth is tipping over. And the king says, right, okay, if this is going to happen, we're going to build pyramids. So that's what they did. You know, that's what the legend tells us that was the purpose of these structures, was to prevent, you know, or was to ensure that they could survive this coming cataclysm. Now, if you think of the earth tipping over, Cliff, you've got parts of the world in polar regions, okay? Now, if those polar regions are moving through crustal displacement, they're shifting away from the polar axis. They're actually moving into temperate zones. Now, if you've got a ton of ice, like the Cordilleran ice sheet during the end of the ice age, we still don't know why those ice sheets melted. We still don't know why those ice sheets melted. And Charles Hapgood has put forward a ton of evidence to show that the earth shifted.
Yeah.
That's why they melted. Now, that's not that. If you think these ice sheets are melting away, say over 300 years, it's building up a big bowl of water over the landmass of Central America. I don't mean Central America. I mean Central United States. Yeah. Like Glacial Lake Missoula, like Glacial Lake Agassiz. You know, these were massive, massive lakes that we know existed in, you know, the central landmass of the United States thousands and thousands of years ago. And they disappeared like that in an instant.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens here is they're melting over centuries, and it builds up a big bowl of water in the middle. And eventually the pressure of that water on the edge of the bowl, the ice dam at the edge of the bowl, it suddenly breaks, and it releases a phenomenal amount of water into the ocean, and that would cause there's legends of a wall of water that was 2 miles high.
Yeah, tsunamis.
Yeah, tsunami, you know, crashing over the continents of the world.
Yeah.
No, Meltwater Pulse 1B, right smack bang in the middle of the Younger Dryas. You know, that would, I mean, I think it's Randall Carlson, following on from the work of J. Harlan Brett's, that showed these massive, you know how on a beach cliff, on a beach you see these small ripples in the sand, as the tide comes in and out, it leaves these small ripples on the sand. They're only a centimetre or so high, or a couple of centimetres, Well, in the channeled scablands in, you know, the northwest of America, they have, J. Harlan Brett's discovered these ripples, and these ripples, they're like 15, 20 feet high, these ripples. Now, that is an absolute unimaginable torrent of water that just basically tore through that part of the world. Now, here's the other interesting thing. That's going to cause all sorts of, you know, tsunamis all over the world, as that suddenly, you know, thrown into the ocean. You know, with tsunamis all over the world. And here's the other thing. Randall Carlson has also found, I don't know if you've heard of the Richard structure on in Mauritania, where they believe it's now believed it's the best candidate for the capital city of Atlantis.
No. What country is that in?
Mauritania. It's in the Western Sahara. And it's just south of the Atlas Mountains, and you know the first king of Atlantis was called Atlas. Herodotus. Apparently, there's this ancient map that's attributed to Herodotus, but probably was composed by various authors over the years, the centuries, millennia, and it shows right where this recat structure exists. It's called the Eye of the Sahara, or the Eye of Africa. And it's got these concentric rings, just like Atlantis was supposed to have.
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah, it's
right.
The tip of Africa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Randall Carlson has been investigating it recently, and he noticed the very same ripple effect that he noticed in the channeled scablands, these ripples of a massive flood, 15, 20 feet high ripples, right on the doorstep of the Eye of Africa, you know, the Eye of Sahara, this research structure, it's right there. The research structure, there's the salt on the surface of this research structure, sea salt. Well, it must have been below seawater at some point in order to get sea salt, you know, on top of it. You know, our Earth has gone through dramatic changes. And, you know, I think our science is, it's just seems to be behind the game line a bit.
Lost in theory. Yeah.
It's like, that can't happen. That can't possibly happen. You know, the Earth can't tilt. Well, you know, there's no such thing. Pole shifts can't happen. Well, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the observation of the Russian cosmonaut, Zhanibekov. He was a Russian cosmonaut in the 1980s on Salyut 7. And he was unscrewing a handle on this panel in the space station. And he just flipped it with his hand, and the thing just spun loose. And it kept spinning through the space station like this, spinning through. And then suddenly it went like that. And kept on spinning. It flipped 180 degrees, and then it flipped again and carried on. So it's going like this, flipping of its own accord, 180 degrees at regular intervals. Now, the Russian government kept that secret for about 10 years because they couldn't understand why this was happening. And actually, it turns out that we actually know why it's happening. The mathematics of it had been worked out, I think, in the early 19th century. And it's to do with what's called the tennis racket theorem, or the intermediate axis theorem, where basically an object can have, you know, three different planes that it can turn. And if one of those planes, if it's not perfectly symmetrical, or perfectly balanced, then it will naturally, in a zero gravity environment, it will flip naturally of its own accord.
Wow.
Now, the Earth is a ball in space. Yeah. Just like this handle on this space station, it's the same thing. You know, but scientists say, oh, no, the Earth can't flip. The Earth can't flip because the Earth only has one rotational axis. It doesn't have an intermediate axis. It requires an intermediate axis in order to, you know, have a, you know, for the Zhanibekov effect to occur. But you know what? See, if you have a massive bowl of water lying over, you know, the central part of the United States, and it suddenly moves from there to over there, that's a sudden change in the balance of the Earth. That is going to introduce an intermediate axis.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does so, then there is absolutely the chance that the Earth will be affected by the Zhanibekov effect.
That's fascinating. Amazing. Let's get into the scan pyramid team.
Yeah.
I want you to provide us with the details of this. Now, your hypothesis is that the Great Pyramid was a storage chamber for future generations to have data about the past. And this void, in your hypothesis, is the holding chamber for perhaps Osiris's body, perhaps Edgar Cayce's Hall of Records, who knows what. But talk about the scan. What was the technology used? And what, first of all, how did they get permission to do this?
With a great deal of difficulty.
And money.
Yeah, absolutely.
They paid a ton of money. Yeah.
That's a bottom dollar. That's it in a nutshell, you know. But you know, it was as you said at the top of the show, Cliff. It was an international team of 30 scientists using muon tomography or myography, which is kind of just like an X-ray. You know, it basically measures different densities. An X-ray measures different densities in the human body and highlights these densities with, you know, different shades. The same thing happens with myography. It basically can X-ray rock and it can find similar different densities within rock. And these muons are basically sort of byproducts of cosmic rays. Okay, so they're here all the time. They're here all the time. And they developed a technique for actually recording these muons as they pass through, you know, solid rock. Just like, you know, an X-ray film, they have these plates with the film inside them. And
sure, cosmic yeah.
Just like that, like an X-ray. And so they discovered this massive void in 2017, November 2017. It was announced in the journal Nature. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Egyptologists went a bit ballistic because they hadn't been consulted before the information was released. And, that was frowned upon, you know, and the scientists, I actually wrote to the scientists and asking for more information, but they couldn't release any information until they had permission now from the Egyptian authorities to do so. But
so talk a little bit about the size of the void. What I found was quite fascinating in your analysis is that it's roughly the size of the great hallway or inner chamber as you leave, the Grand Gallery, it's called. Yep. So yep. Talk a little bit about the dimensions of this void.
Well, from what the scientists have discovered, it seems to be as large as the Grand Gallery. It's absolutely massive. It's about 100 feet long. It's about 10, 12 feet wide and about 30 feet high.
Wow.
Which is the same as the Grand Gallery.
Yeah.
Now, Egyptologists don't really know why the Grand Gallery is there either. So they've got no chance of figuring out why there's a second grand gallery, if you like. But this is what my book explains, why those two galleries are actually there. And the Grand Gallery, I don't know if you're aware of this, Cliff, on either side of the Grand Gallery, it's got a pavement, or what you would call a sidewalk.
Yeah.
And it's a couple of feet wide. On either side of the Grand Gallery, it goes all the way up, on either side, two pavements all the way up the Grand Gallery. And in each of these pavements, there are 27 sockets or notches dug into the pavement, against the wall, dug into the pavement. And these notches or sockets are about 2 to 3 feet long. Okay, they're 8 inches deep and a few inches wide, or about 6, 8 inches wide.
Yeah, I saw them in 2019 when I was inside the pyramid. So
you
I know
what I'm talking about then.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a tradition that's come down to us from Al-Mamun, who was the guy that basically dug his way into the Great Pyramid, blasted this tunnel that we go through today, Mamun's tunnel. And there's a legend that says that he, when he first entered the Grand Gallery, saw all these statues.
Oh, my God. What year was that?
It was about 800 AD, something like that.
Oh, okay. It's a long time ago.
Yeah, he saw these statues inside the Grand Gallery. And that makes actual sense, because that's what these sockets were for. There's a researcher called Andre Pochan in the 1970s. He wrote this great book, and he speculated that these sockets and these two sidewalks were for the statues of Khufu's ancestors. Okay? Mm-hmm. Because if you understand the Egyptian religion, when a king is buried, he's always buried with a statue. Yeah? Do you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah. Okay.
So all these and the statue's always in the lower part of the tomb. You see where I'm going with this?
So would you say that in its heyday, when these statues were there, this was like a memorial, but also a repository of data? So people would come in there, they'd walk by these statues, and only the sacred priests had access to this void?
Well, no, the void is completely isolated.
That was my next question. There's no stair. They didn't scan and find a walkway or a block pathway that leads from one way to the other. So it's totally encapsulated inside the pyramid. Yes. It has no in or out.
There's no in or out. There's no passageways, tunnels, or anything to the void.
Okay.
And that is why the ancient Coptic Egyptian texts tell us that, as well as putting all these seeds and, tools and weapons and knowledge inside this monument so that their kingdom could be reborn again, what these texts also tell us is that inside the Great Pyramid, they placed Khufu's ancestors. And I speculate in my new book that they placed these ancestors within the big void. Now, there's a very, very specific reason for doing that. And it's to do with, again, it's to do with their religion, because the ancient Egyptians believed that the king was effectively more important in death than he was in life. So all Khufu's ancestors, this flood is coming, and it's going to rip up the land, it's going to rip up all their tombs and decimate them. If the king's body was destroyed in any way, or hurt or damaged in any way, then the king could no longer, in his death, could no longer intercede or commune with the gods for the benefit of Egypt, to ensure that the crops would grow, the sun would rise, the Nile would flow. That was their job in the afterlife, in their death. That is what the dead kings, the Osiris kings, or the dead kings, that is what their job was to do. Now, if you've got a flood coming that's going to destroy, rip up all their graves and destroy all their bodies, what do? You put them somewhere really safe, as high as you can above the floodwaters, and you make sure, because this was the other thing that the ancient Egyptians did with when they buried their kings, is they created a statue for them, because if the body, the mummification didn't work and the body started to decay, then the king's soul would, you know, be destroyed. It would just disappear. That was the end of it. That was his afterlife finished. He could no longer intercede with the gods. So what they would do is they would create a statue for the king. For the mummified body, they would create a statue in the image and the likeness of the king, so that the king's soul had a surrogate body, if you like, to continue this eternal cycle of communion with the gods. And that is why we have the gallery below with all the statues and the one above with the actual mummified bodies. That's what's in the big void.
Wow. Hey, in the time we have left, Scott, I don't want to get into the problems with Egyptology and their dislike of this technology, because it doesn't make any sense.
No,
it's just a sad situation. And I've had Egyptologists on here to say that Egyptology is dead. And you have to wonder why, because they're backwards, they're not forward thinking, and they are not really happy to see multidisciplinary or other sciences involved. But this team, this scan pyramid team, as far as you can tell, they never got a chance to fly a drone into that chamber, have they? Because that was their plan, wasn't it? To create a hole in the upper body of the pyramid and fly a drone to see what was in there.
Well, that was one idea that was kind of floated around. What I've heard is that they have a team up there in the Campbell's chamber. You know, these vice chambers that I was telling you about that he blasted his way into? Well, the very top one above the king's chamber, the very, very top one, which has got a vaulted roof like that, it's actually sort of parallel with the top of the big void. So I've heard that they're planning to drill horizontally through that roof block in Campbell's chamber to create a small hole into the big void, and probably, I would suspect, to put an endoscopic camera through that hole.
See what they got, yeah.
Yeah, because I don't think they would fancy the idea too much of this small drone that's flying about. Anything could happen in there.
Yeah, it could knock something over. Yeah.
You know, well, not so much that, but, you know, it could get trapped in there, you know, and that's it. You know, people in a million years' time, why was the pyramid built, and they find this technology that's completely of a different age, you know, inside this chamber? They'll be like, how did that get there? You know, you know. So I think we'd be a bit careful about leaving stuff behind. But just in a final note here, Cliff, Hawass and Dr. American Egyptologist Dr. Lehner that you mentioned earlier, at the beginning of the discovery back in 2017, they were really, really skeptic. Oh, it's just a big void. It's just a space. It's just, you know, an artifact of how the pyramid was built. Nothing will be found in it, et cetera, et cetera. But now they're saying, we suspect something significant may well be found in this space.
Yeah. We could spend an hour talking about Hawass and Lehner. They are the naysayers. They are not forward-thinking, and they are very, very repressive in their views of new discoveries. The book's called The Great Pyramid Void Enigma. My guest today has been Scott Creighton. Scott, give us a final thought, a synopsis of what you believe. I mean, you've told us that you believe that this chamber probably is bits and pieces of past legends, most notably Edgar Cayce's view of the Hall of the Records with evidence of Atlantis and other earlier civilizations, and perhaps these pharaohs that were pre-dynastic. We have to consider them pre-dynastic when you consider the age. But tell us a little bit in conclusion of what you would hope to see in that chamber.
Well, I think if I'm right, and you've seen the arguments in the book, Cliff, there's a lot of evidence I present in the book, other than what we've spoke about this evening, that there's a very, very good chance that what I'm saying is actually right. But the bigger issue to think about here, Cliff, is why they did this. Why it was about pole shifts. It was about protecting their civilization from this cycle of pole shift events, which I have come to believe is actually, from what the ancients tell us, also is a natural cycle of the Earth. It's a natural part of the Earth's geophysics, this pole shift, especially when, massive weights on the Earth are moved from one part of the Earth to another suddenly. This is a natural event that cannot be stopped, and it occurs after, certain periods. So that's the thing I think we have to keep in mind as to why the ancient Egyptians really did build these pyramids. And it was to protect themselves, to protect their civilization, to ensure it could be reborn again. And, Egyptologists have kind of got this half right. They know that the pyramids were connected with rebirth of some kind, the afterlife. But it wasn't the afterlife of the king or the rebirth of the king, at least not initially. It was about the rebirth and the afterlife, the rebirth of the kingdom.
Yeah, amazing. Fantastic. Scott, best of luck. For those of you listening, The Great Pyramid Void Enigma is now available. It just came out this month. I just was looking at your press release,
yes.
Scott.
Yes,
So that means it's on all your favorite websites, including Amazon. If you're not a fan of Amazon, you probably can find it in your local bookstore, those that are left, unfortunately. So, hey, Scott, continue success with this. I think it's a fascinating look at this, and I appreciate your research and your clarity on these huge, huge megalithic structures of the past. So, hey, thanks for being with me.
It's been a pleasure, Cliff. Absolute pleasure. And hope it's not so long till next time.
All right. Cheers. You have to ask yourself, why are Egyptologists, perhaps even archaeologists, reluctant to find out what is in the void? Why would Zahi Hawass say, hey, there's nothing there. There's nothing to see here. Move on, kids. And others like Mark Lehrner, downplay the potential for wonderful success. It's just so crazy. It doesn't make any sense to me, and it's very irritating. And I think that at some point he will be remembered as a buffoon. You know, I'm talking Zahi Hawass. And I'm not going to talk a lot more about him, but there's a very poignant preview of his behavior about 5-6 years ago when he was invited to debate Graham Hancock in, I think it was Paris, and he went ballistic prior to the beginning of the debate because the name Robert Bovall came out. And if you don't know who Robert Bovall is, he wrote a book on the Great Pyramid and its alignment to the Orion constellation. And for some reason, it irked Hawass to the point where he publicly denounced Bovall, said that he was he called him all kinds of names. It was really unprofessional. That should have been it. Most people in office, especially in the United States, would have been removed. But because Egypt is living in the Middle Ages, he was allowed to stay on. It wasn't until it was discovered he was selling antiques that he was removed from office. And he's just a real bad seed. And I'm really disappointed, not only in him, but in the whole antiquities department for keeping everybody in the dark about Egypt. So I would love to know what the Scan Pyramid organization paid the antiquities department. It must have been several million dollars to allow these intricate scans, getting into every crack and crevice to place these plates, these emulsion plates that picked up these particles to detect these voids. And you know what? Why can't we, you know, drill and find out what's in the this chamber, this space that is as big as the Grand Gallery? So there's a lot of really questionable behavior that isn't really discussed. And this is what we face, you know, when we're talking about ancient places. And I face this a lot whenever I go to Mexico, and I've been going there for over 20 years, 25 years, actually. It's just that the old guard is falling by the wayside, and they are rebelling, and they are restricting shaman and sacred ceremonies on archaeological parks in Mexico. I've talked about this. You know, here we are in Egypt, and you can't use ground-penetrating radar. I mean, it's probably going to let more than one cat out of the bag if they were to do that. So I have to say this, though. We're planning a tour in May. Now, the confirmed dates is May 3rd through the 15th, 2022. At that point, the brand new Egyptian museum will be open. Let's cross our fingers. It's been delayed for years. And I have a lot of people telling me that there are a ton of very, very fabulous artifacts, many anomalies that have been stuck under many floors of the old museum in downtown Cairo and have been placed for easy access and viewing in this new billion-dollar museum that's located just below the Giza Plateau, this new grand Egyptian museum. So we'll see what happens. It's fun to talk about, but at some point we have to have the so-called orthodoxy wake up a little bit, and it can be a little disheartening to expect revelations and get suppression. So anyhow, I enjoyed that interview, and I hope you did too, with our friend Scott Crichton. And that book, by the way, is on Amazon right now, or try finding it in your local bookstore if you're not patronizing Amazon. See if you can find it in your local bookstore, because it's the only book out as of now that talks about these voids and what they could be. So very, very nice insight. I hope you enjoyed it as well. Hey, if you're enjoying Earth Ancients, please consider becoming a subscriber. For as little as $5 a month, you can support the work we do here, not only on Earth Ancients, but our new sister podcast, Destiny. And Destiny is offering and continues to offer a really eclectic presentation of experts, scientists, medical people, providing you insight into our future, but also what I like to call tools for transformation. So to become a subscriber, go to Patreon, that's patreon.com/Earth Ancients, and check it out. There's a lot of ebooks available, and I am now launching the Conversations with Cliff monthly Zoom meeting where you can sit down, we can talk, you can ask me questions. I'll tell you what I think about stuff, some of my insight. Also, I'm going to show some photos and some new video of the Black Knight satellite that have come to me, as well as a lot of other things that I can't really talk about on the show for various reasons. So please join us as a subscriber. Go to patreon.com/Earth Ancients. Hey, I want to mention Earth Ancients has been nominated for a People's Choice Podcast Award. And we were nominated about a month ago, and now we can take voting. So if you want to vote for Earth Ancients as your favorite history, be it alternative or whatever, podcast, go to peopleschoiceawards.com and just register and let us, you know, say, yeah, I dig it. Just check it off. You'll see it there. Earth Ancients, your favorite podcast. History, under history. So check it out. People's Choice Award, every year they vote from their favorites or people's favorites from around the world. So, and I love it. We've gotten some awards from the French Consortium of Media last year, and we've had some other smaller awards. But hey, People's Choice would be great. So peopleschoiceawards.com, check it out, and vote if you're inclined to do so. All right, that's it for this program. I want to thank Scott Crichton, as always, the team of Ruth Thomas, Ruth U. Rock, and editing team and others. Fantastic, fun show. I hope you enjoyed it. And we will talk to you next week.